Good morning, I'm Bob and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Whew, that felt good. Before I begin my story, I want to read the promises. And I got to get a little help here. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
We think not.
No, we think not. They're being filled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Thank God. Again, good morning. My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you folks for coming here this morning. And I want to thank Sarah for asking, and my wife says thank you. Apparently, these past 2 weeks, I've been a little more humble than usual. So she wanted to say thank you. It's indeed an honor and a privilege to not only to be asked, but to have enough of this program to come up here and speak with you. When I was out there, right before I came in, the fear in me was so huge. It got to the point where I hated being the first person at a stoplight, right? Because you're the one in control when that light goes from red to green and you got to do something and you got all these people behind you and everyone's staring at you. The fear and the paranoia was just, it just had me. Our daughter is 14. My daughter and my wife couldn't be here today because she is in a volleyball tournament. When our daughter was in second grade, she came home one day, all excited, coming off the bus, her little backpack, clinching onto this piece of paper. She was really excited. And my wife was too, and I was until I read the paper. My daughter volunteered me to speak to her second grade class on career day. Now, I was out there. I was not in the program. I was not sober. And the thought of speaking to a small group of second graders scared the shit out of me. Those little humans with their little heads all staring at you, you know. And you have to entertain them because they will turn on you, you know. And I couldn't do it. So I did what I did best. I lied. I got out of it. I lied to my daughter and broke her heart. I lied to my wife and disappointed her. I didn't care. I got out of it. I did what I wanted to do, not what my little girl asked me. And that here I am today, bigger room, sorry, bigger humans, bigger heads all staring at me, right? And yet I have, and I'm getting it now, the goosebumps, this sense of joy and peace and love that I thought alcohol would bring and never did. You know, I always tried to get out of my stuff. The pain, the fear, whatever it was, I had to just push it away. You know, and that's why I drank. But here I am today, almost 6 years in the program, and I'm standing in front of you, and I swear to God, I'm calm. This is, if you haven't done this, you got to do this. This is a trip. I love you, and thank you for being here. But it wasn't always that way. I was born in Chicago, born and raised in Chicago, May of 1961. Yes, I have 50 looming ahead, and I'm embracing it. 50's not the new 30, 60's not the new 40. That's just a bunch of baby boomers that just can't deal with getting older, you know. It's I'm going to be 50, and I love it. My parents were relatively young when I was born. My mother was 18, my father was in his young 20s. Kids. I'm the oldest of two. I've got a sister who's 4 years younger than me. And my childhood was good. Doing even my inventory, looking back, up until I was around 11 or 12, it was good. Until about that time, I realized that my father was drinking, and he drank. And before I continue with my story, I got to tell a little background. My father is an alcoholic, and he's dry. On my mother's side, my grandfather is alcoholic. I have it on both sides. My grandfather came over to this country from Norway. He didn't start drinking until he was 40. And when he was 44, he was found dead in the gutter. Skid Row bum. I mean, it took him that quick. We don't know where he's buried. He's in one of those massive graves in some cemetery in Chicago someplace. We have no idea. There's no headstone for the man. We just know that this disease took him in 4 years. So I have it on both sides. Like I said, my dad drank, and one of my earlier memories of that is Saturdays, he would sit in front of the house in his lawn chair, and the neighbor would come by and sit in his lawn chair, and they would drink beer. And with the empties, they would construct this pyramid, right? And I knew if they were on the first row, it was okay for me to come home. Everything was fine. If they were on the second row, it was 50-50. If they were on the third row and going up, I wouldn't come home, because the madman would now would appear. And I'd wait until I saw my mom's car in front of the house, because she worked on Saturdays. And when I saw the car was there, the buffer was at home between me and the old man. So now I would come home. My first drink, I was 13. Have you ever seen that movie, Dazed and Confused? The kid with the Led Zeppelin black t-shirt and blue and puking, that was me. That first drink, I hear in these rooms how people will drink and they get that instant glow. That's what happened to me, you know, right away. I loved it. Overshot the first time, second time, third time, and thereafter, but I loved it. And what was beneficial was my buddy and I, his older brother and sister, would get us into all the parties. So here we are, two 13-year-old kids getting into these, you know, 17, 18-year-old parties and just getting loaded. I would spend the weekends at Al's house. His parents were pretty much not around, so every weekend we would just go out and party. Smoked a lot of pot. Every day before school, we'd get high. I also worked at the Park District as a janitor. And one of the executives, I won't mention what office he was in, and his credenza had booze, and the key was in the lower left-hand cabinet. And before I'd leave at night, ride my bike home, I'd open up the cabinet and take a few hits. And he never said anything, probably because also hidden in that cabinet was his porn. So, and it wasn't the normal Playboy stuff. It was this really weird Eastern German stuff that still disturbs me to this day, and I know there's a few that are probably going to ask me what it was like, and I'm not going to tell you. Bruce, it's going to be in my next inventory. It's these things come up. It was bad. Anyways, so after work, I would take a few hits, grab a Coke out of a machine, and ride my bike home. My grades were average. If it was a subject that I liked, I did well. If it was a subject I didn't care about, I got by. You know, I did well enough to get into Western Illinois University. My first semester, I joined a fraternity. And I joined them only because, number one, they hated the rest of the frats. They didn't get involved in all the activities. But they always had beer on tap in the bar in the basement, 24/7. Miller was on tap. Sounded like a good reason to join, so I joined. Also, my first semester, I come home and I get a letter that I'm on academic probation. You get 2 C's and 3 D's, and you're on the edge of getting your ass thrown out. From that moment on, I figured it out, and I was able to get nothing but A's and B's in my courses. I would kind of separate them. Study, party, sleep, go to class, study, party, sleep. And that's all I would do, and I would keep everything separate. And I kind of was able to manage that for a while. Also, what happened that first semester, I got a phone call from my father. Now, back up a little bit. From the time I was 13 until I'm away at college, my father and I did not get along. And it was worse than the typical teenage rebellion. It was, at sometimes, nasty, physical. We actually got in a few fist fights. Right? So in that period, I just cast off my whole family. I wanted nothing to do with any of them. When I went away to school, I realized I got away from the madness that was going on in our house, and I wanted nothing to do with my family. But one day I get this phone call, and this is 1979, and my father calls to tell me that he's going into rehab. Okay. Well, I just want you to know that, you know, I've got a drinking problem, and I'm going to fix this, and I'm going to go into rehab. Okay. I just want you to know. Okay. I didn't give a shit. I could care less. That's his problem, not mine. Come home from Christmas, and we're going to go to a family counseling center, a nice little family counseling session, to talk about the family problem. And I was not going. I was defiant to the core. I just, arms crossed, I ain't going. I don't have a problem. He's got the problem. He needs to go, not me. My sister was livid. Go in the car. She goes in the car. My mother was furious with me. You know, how can you do this to the family? I'm not doing anything to the family. He's doing it to the family. Right. She goes in the car. I go upstairs. And I hear him walking up the stairs. I'm like, here we go. I'm getting ready. Here we go. Knocks on the door, opens it, and says, you don't want to go. I ain't going. Okay. You don't have to go. I don't blame you. In fact, Robert, and he's the only one that calls me Robert. If I were you, I wouldn't want to go either. Don't worry about it. I'll talk to your mother. And he left. We talk in the book about the change that happens in the family and these moments that happen. That was it with my father and I. I noticed a change, completely different than one I scripted in my head what was going to happen, completely different. And then from that moment on, he was a completely different man. Sophomore year, I don't have a major. You know, I have no idea what I'm doing. All my buddies are now starting to take higher level courses, and I'm still dwindling into 200 level classes, running out of shit to go to. You know? Yeah. Yeah, you know, intro to this, intro to that, you know. So I call home. Another big difference. I would call home and just ask for, you know, hey, is mom there? But now this time I called home and asked for dad. And I laid it out. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know what I'm doing. Well, why don't you come home? No, you don't understand. I'm in school. I'm working. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm getting A's in all my classes, and I'm up to my, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here. I hear you. Come home. We got this junior college down the road. Why don't you come home, right? Work a little bit. Go to school. You'll figure it out. It was almost like a sponsor. That option never entered my head. It was either succeed or fail. There was no plan B. So that's what I did. I came home. And I'm going to stop right here. I'm going to tell you when I stopped drinking, right? Instead of going through a whole drunkalogue. Your job is just to assume since I was 13 to 6 years ago, I'm drinking, and it's just getting worse. I'll let you know when I stop. And there's a couple brief moments in there that I did. So I come home, stop drinking, and I started running a lot, exercising, started doing half marathons and all that stuff, really got into it, and stumbled upon a chemistry class that I took. And I don't know why, but for some reason, it just clicked with me. Fearful, I never took chemistry in high school, never took it up till then because I was afraid I wasn't good enough, smart enough to take it. For some reason, it just clicked with me. So I just, I'll major in chemistry, which is what I eventually became. Also at that time, I stopped drinking, but I'm still getting high. My buddy Scott, who was my high school friend, was going to junior college, and he had a motorcycle. And one day he was going to go and buy a bag, four finger bag of weed. And so I said, "Yeah, let's go." And he said, "Well, helmets. Hey, when your time's up, your time's up." He's like, "That's the spirit." And we tossed the helmets. Got on the bike, got the bag of weed, sampled it, drove home, rush hour, coming up to a busy intersection, 40 miles an hour, and this poor old lady in a big Buick, opposite direction, making a left-hand turn, pulls out right in front of us. I don't recall the impact. The doctor at the time says I never will. All I know is we skidded, and then I was flying. Through traffic, all I can think was I tucked and rolled, got up. I had literally scratches. I'm checking my eyes, my mouth, my ears for fluid. I'm fine. I've fallen off of monkey bars as a kid, and I got more busted. And I turn around, and Scott is just busted up. He died later on that night. And the whole idea of guilt and survivor's guilt, why did I live? I was a passenger in that bike. I'm the one that's supposed to die, not my friend. I'm the one that said no helmets, not my friend. You know, all that stuff just kind of, so you got to drink to push that stuff away. So I started drinking again. I would have found another excuse, but I started drinking again. One class, I'm sitting there, first day of class, and this blonde walks in. It's going to be a good semester. She sits in front of me. It's going to be even better. She turned around and she asked me a question about the book or syllabus. I have no idea. All I know is I got lost in her eyes, man, and I still do. That was my wife. We became friends, and I won't tell you the story about our first date, but we started dating. It started out as I called her up, I had tickets to a concert. I'm embarrassed what it was, but The Go-Go's. It's 1983. Come on, you know. So, I was more interested in the opening act, in Excess, which not many people knew about, and yeah, that's my story. Anyway, so I asked her. I called her up, and she said, "Well, is this a date, or are we going as friends?" And me, being the tool I was, says, "Well, we'll go as friends. If you want it to be a date, you know, it'll be a date." Asshole. I walk up to the door, and she's got this short skirt, and it was a date. We're on a date, and we started dating at that moment. I graduate, transfer to Northeastern Illinois University, start working as a QC chemist at a chemical plant. We get married in 1985. I stopped drinking. Right. I'm working second shift. She's working first. We are struggling in this little shitty one-bedroom apartment on the north side of Chicago, scraping to save money. And on our first anniversary, we decided to go out to see Second City. Second City is kind of like where a lot of the Saturday Night Live guys and women start, you know, cut their teeth. So we decided to go and see a show at Second City. Big night, we get in a cab, and I said, "You know, I'm thinking of maybe having a beer or two." And, you know, my wife knew nothing about alcoholism. She's like, "Yeah, you know, we just have one or two, that'd be fine, you can handle that." And the night was absolute hell for me, because we're sitting there in this nightclub and all the skits going on, and I'm just watching at the levels of our drinks, because see, I'm not alcoholic, so I can't be drinking faster than her, and I gotta make sure that those levels are somewhat the same. Insanity. What I wanted was to pound the beer, order a round of, you know, shots of tequila, and let's keep going. So I tried to control my drinking for the next few years. And then I got introduced to Coke. I loved Coke. I love cocaine. My wife never touched it. My wife will have one or two beers. Ooh, I'm feeling it, and then start drinking milk, you know. But I loved Coke and was doing a lot of it. She would see a little bit of it, but I'm starting to hide this stuff. And then I'm starting to realize the day after I do Coke, my fingers, I'm getting this pins and needles sensation that won't go away for a day or two. And I'm noticing every time I do Coke the next day, I'm getting this really strange pins and needles. And that's the only reason I quit doing Coke, because I was so scared that I did some damage to my brain someplace where this sensation is going on. So I stopped. And I just ramped up the drinking. Buy a house in the burbs. We move out. I quit. Go to my first AA meeting thinking, you know what, I might have an issue like my old man. I go to a speaker meeting. It's some guy talking about him being a Skid Row bum and all the stuff he did. And I'm like, that's not me. I'm fine. So I left and I went back to drinking. I'm not an alcoholic. Sons are born. And now I'm starting to hide it. And what I would do at that point, we started having O'Doul's was available, right? So you start masking it because you got O'Doul's in the house, but in the garage you got your real stuff. And then you one day you figure out, you know, if I pour out the O'Doul's, I knew you'd like that. You pour in, I could walk around the house and pretend I'm drinking O'Doul's as I'm getting loaded. It's just getting worse. In 1994, we moved to Georgia. Great career move for me. And full steam ahead. Wasn't until we get down here and I realized, what the hell have I done? The fear again. I just uprooted my family. We moved from Chicago, the first of my wife's or my family to move out of Chicago. You know, what are you kids doing? You know, Georgia, why you moved to Georgia. And I'm not comfortable. I'm not comfortable. They're going to figure this out. They're going to find me out. I'm a phony. They're going to find me out. I'm not good. I'm not worthy. I can't do this. I got to drink. And I'm hiding. I'm still hiding it, and it's getting worse. And see, what you do is when you bring the stuff in the basement, you got to get it out somehow if you're being secret. And I realized that the bottles, if I wrapped 3 pieces of paper around the bottle, you don't hear the cleaning as I'm trying to get it out of the house. It's insane. I now am a field chemist, and I've got Georgia and Alabama that I'm covering, so I'm out on the road all the time, and it's getting worse. Our daughter's born, and I can't lay on my sides to play with her because my sides are starting to ache. I go to the doctor and get some blood work, and you know, you get the low and high where everything should be, and my blood work came back just all over the place. And I didn't follow up. I was too scared to even see what might have been going on. I knew what was going on, you know. But booze just gets a hold of you. And we talk about losing the power of choice. It was gone. And that you start telling yourself, well, I haven't done this. You don't talk about what you have done or what you are doing. You start playing games with yourself. Well, I haven't done this. All right? Well, I haven't lost a job. Yeah. I never got a DUI. I never hit my wife. And you know what? I don't drink in the morning. And then you come here and you start clearing out your skull, and you go back and you say, well, let's examine these 4 things. It's true. I never lost a job. I guarantee I was months away from getting axed. I never got a DUI. Only because I never got caught. I drove loaded all the time. For you guys that got caught, fuck it, I'm sorry. You got caught. I didn't. It's the way it is. But I endangered you and your family and everyone else on the road. Irresponsible. Just because I didn't get caught doesn't change anything. It's true, I never hit my wife. But the anger and the violence and the insanity brewing in me, I can almost guarantee you it was just a matter of time. And then never drinking in the morning. Your family goes to sleep at 9 at night. Your wife and your kids are all in bed. By 9:15, they're asleep. And that's when you throw it into fourth gear. And you go out in the basement, and you just start hitting it hard. And you pass out on the couch around 12, 1 o'clock. You don't go in bed because you don't want your wife to smell your breath. So you fall asleep on the couch. You fall asleep. It's bullshit. You pass out. And around 4:30, you come to again. You don't wake up. You come to. And the pain, the shakes, it won't stop. And then the voices. And it's not one voice where you're having a give and take conversation. It's a lot of voices, and they're all talking at once, and you're shaking. And you gotta stop it. So you go to the basement in your wood shop. And in your basement, along the wall is this old mirror that your father's dad, your grandfather, built up in Chicago in the 30s. And he passed it to his son, and your father passed it to you. And it's this big, big, huge mirror. and you put a blanket over it because you don't want to look at yourself at 4:30 in the morning as you're getting loaded. You can't. And then one day, you're hearing these noise upstairs. It's the kitchen. It's your children getting ready for school. You're drinking in the morning. August 28, 2005. I'm in the shower. Sorry. I wish it was better. I wish it was either in the gutter or something cool, but I was in the shower. Sunday morning, my wife comes in. Morning. Morning. And I hear the words. Are you drinking? Because see, the night before, you got this weird law in Georgia about Sunday, right? Fucking, you're a pain in the ass, you know. It doesn't bother me now, but at the time, you know, it's just inconvenient. So you got to buy a lot Saturday and figure out, oh, I got for Saturday night, then I got for Sunday, and, you know, maybe for Monday. So you got to work this out somehow, right? And what you normally do when you walk out of the bottle shop is you take the receipt and you just stuff it in your pocket. Normally you throw it in the trash, but this time you stuffed it in your pocket. And at night, when it's dark, you know, you go to your, you know, your side in the bathroom, the vanity where all your shit is, and you just throw all your stuff out, right? Your wallet and all that stuff. And you didn't realize that you left the receipt to the bottle shop right there. And 6 months before, I have been begging God to make it stop. On my hands and knees on that cold cement floor in the basement, crying into the ground, please help me. I can't stop. I've heard speakers say this. If you were to put a lie detector on me and if you would have said, Bob, you want to quit drinking? Yes, it would have registered truth. And I tried on my own. I can't tread water. I'm no good. I would last a day and go right back into it because I can't stop. Are you drinking? Fuck. That look on her face. As long as I live, I don't ever want her to have that look on her face again. Just shock, hurt, disappointment. Just list them all. Yeah, I'm drinking. Walked out of the room. There I am in the shower. Water hitting me. Had to be this way, huh? Fine. And I was angry. I was scared. Embarrassed. But most of all, relieved. It's over. That's it. Game up. I'm done. At that moment, I decided, all right, whatever you want, we'll do it your way. Went downstairs and told her, I said, listen, I'll contact AA and I'll do whatever they say. I said, I'm not going to promise, and I told her, I'm not going to promise you anything. All I can do is show you. And that was it. Next day, Monday morning, 10 o'clock, I come here, I Googled it, and the fire department was really kind to tell me, no, it's around over here. I walk up and I meet this man with the hat and the feathers and all that shit. And you know. Yeah, Claude. And I swear to God, this is embarrassing, but I don't know what I said, but he's like, yeah, yeah, we got a chair with your name on it, and God is my witness. I'm walking through the first door, and I'm walking into the second door, and all I can think is, I got to find the chair with the name Bob on it. You said to be honest, Sarah. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, that's, you know. And that first day, I don't know, the first meeting, you know, they're talking about shit and all that. You know, would the newcomer like to share? They just started crying. I have no idea what I said. And this one lady came up and gave me a hug and said, "It's all right, baby. You're home. You're going to be fine." Oh, that little bit of relief. I was like a little boy, you know. It's going to be okay. And Claude, you know, I don't smoke, but I borrowed a cigarette off him, and I'm in front, you know. First 3 weeks of sobriety, I smoked and ate a lot of chocolate. You said something about sugar and chocolate, so I ate a lot of chocolate and smoked. Didn't drink. And he said, "Yeah, it was a good meeting, 8 o'clock in the morning, called the Breakfast Club." Really? 8. "I'll be here." My first commitment. 8:02, I walked through the door. Saw Claude. He nodded at me, I nodded at him. Okay. He talked to me a little more. As time went on, he introduced me a few guys, and my first sponsor, Danny R. "Danny, I wish you well, brother." And Danny took me through the steps. We're on step 2. And I decide to read ahead. And I come up to step 9. And step 9 scared the shit out of me. "Danny, hey, bro, how's it going?" "I'm..." "Whoa, what's the matter?" "I'm..." What? I said, "I can't tell her this stuff." "Who? My wife. I can't tell..." My God, step 9. Have you seen this thing? You know, yeah. He's like, whoa, what are you talking about? What step are we on? We. 2. Yeah, step 9's miles down. Yeah, but it's there. And right after 8, I see it, you know. He goes, just, "Why don't you tell me, first of all, have you read the whole thing? What does that last part mean?" "It means if it's going to do more harm." He said, "We'll talk more about it later. Okay?" "Yeah? Why don't you just tell me what it is?" "Well, blah, 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 blah." "No, you're not telling her that. It's not what you think. I know you, this group. You're okay? You're a disturbed bunch. I know you well. It's not what you think. I'm here to tell you that I've done a lot of rotten, nasty, shitty things, but I never cheated on my wife, nor do I ever will. It was financial things that I did. Back then, it's different now, but back then, the credit card, if you got up to your limit, they would just add more. And add more, and add more. And it was a chase. Who can get to the limit first, you know? And it was the secret credit card and other shit that I did. And I was just so ashamed. I eventually did, though. I eventually sat down with my wife and told her. And you have ideas in your head what is going to happen. And then what really happens... It wasn't, "You bastard, how can you do this to us? My God, what the hell have you done?" It was, "Oh my God, how long have you been holding on to this? No, I'm not happy about it, but we'll get through it. Are you still doing it?" "No." "No." And I'm... This is interesting. See this little credit card here? It's got my name on it and everything. I know what the balance is. It's the same as my reimbursement check that's coming. Not a penny more. I'm allowed now to have a debit card in our joint account. I wasn't before. I was given an allowance, like a child, because I was one. My wife was raising four kids. Now her and I are raising three. And we worked through it. And now the only debt we have is the mortgage. It's amazing what this program does. It just doesn't stop you from drinking and using. It gives you a way of life that is just beyond what I thought could happen to me if you just let go and let God. And these 12 steps, they apply to everything. They apply to when the day after I got my first year chip, my mother passed away of cancer. This applied when I had to go up there and help my father because he lost the love of his life. And he's an untreated alcoholic, and he was out of his frickin' mind. This works. When Lori passed away, there's a group of us that came in around the same time. It hit me hard. And I asked my wife, you gotta come with me to the service. I can't do this alone. Yeah, I'm gonna be with you. And then when I got to the service, I wasn't alone. I saw you folks. And just like when I first came up here this morning, a little nervous, but all of a sudden as soon as I saw your eyes and your faces, I'm relieved. I'm with my guys. And the minister was reading letters that the family wrote. And the letters really focused on the best years of their lives with his wife and their mother was when Laura was sober and working on her sobriety. I was fine. My wife started to cry. And all the tissue that I brought for me, I gave to her. We're driving home, and she's like, my God, those letters. Yeah. She said, you know, I've never met that family. And I probably never will. But my God, those letters, Bob. I know exactly how they feel. Yeah, well, now you know why I go to AA. I don't know the last names of you guys. I know your names. We look at each other. We know. We got a connection. We're in a meeting and somebody shares and it hits me and I look around the room and it hits you and we see each other's eyes. We know. Life today. Sponsor Bruce, God, I love you. I sponsor guys, and we just keep this chain going. God has always been there. He's always been the foundation of my life. If you're new to this, hang around. Stick with it. If you're feeling something, share it. If you're scared, share it. If you're joy, share it. Give it all to these rooms. I listen to a lot of speaker tapes. A lot of speaker tapes. And Damon, thank you. Thank you. I spend a lot of windshield time. And I love Earl Hightower, Ed Mutin, and Judge Jack. And Judge Jack, when at the end of his talk, he discussed members' eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I read it or listen to it, it hits me. I'm going to try and read this. There's no tissue, but I'm going to try. But I want to end. Thank you, brother. This coming Sunday in the churches of many of us, There will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have seen, what you have heard. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burn with an inner hunger and inner thirst. And that the word gospel quite literally meant the good news. More than 6 years ago, I got here. And you guys working together or by yourselves got me sober, kept me sober, worked with God, and here I am today. And if my family was here and you were to ask them, "Tell us, what did you see?" I would like to think that they would say, "We can only tell you what we have seen and what we have heard." It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. And over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit had the good news told to them. My God, may it always be so. My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, this is a good friend of mine.